she replied, that the shadow did everything in its power to bring down the White Tower. It knew. The White Tower has the ability to rule this war.
We'll need to watch for dreadlords, Swan said, shuffling through papers.
Scouting reports, Gowan suspected. He knew little of Swan Sanche, despite having spared her life, but Egwene commonly spoke of the woman's greed for information.
Yes, Egwene said. They will come.
A Black Tower, Bryn said, frowning. Do you trust the word from Lord Mandragoran?
With my life, Egwene said.
Asherman, fighting for the enemy. Why wouldn't the Dragon Reborn have done something? Like to follow the remaining Asherman's side with the shadow.
Egwene shook her head.
Bryn, I want you to saddle up riders and send them to the area outside the Black Tower where gateways can still be made. Send them riding hard to the sisters still camped outside the Black Tower.
You want them to attack? Gowan asked, perking up.
No. They are to retreat back as far as it takes to make gateways, and then they are to join us here. We can't afford any further delays. I want them here.
She tapped the table with one finger.
Taim and his dreadlords will come. They have stayed away from this battlefield, instead focusing on Lord Mandragoran. That lets them dominate their battlefield as we have this one. I will choose more sisters to send to the Borderlander army. We will have to confront them eventually.
Gowan said nothing, but drew his lips tight. Fewer sisters here meant more work for Egwene and the others.
And now, Egwene said, I need to...
She trailed off, seeing Gowan's expression.
I suppose I need to sleep. If I am needed, send to... Light, I don't know where I'm sleeping today. Gowan?
I have you in Meren Sedai's tent. She's on duty in the rotation after this, so that should give you some hours of uninterrupted sleep.
Unless I'm needed,
Egwene reminded him. She walked toward the tent flaps.
Of course,
Gowan said, following her out, but shaking his head toward Bryn and Swan. Bryn smiled back, nodding. On a battlefield, there was little that would absolutely require the Amarlin's attention. The Hall of the Tower had been given direct oversight of their armies. Outside, Egwene sighed, closing her eyes. He put his arm around her and let her slump against him. The moment lasted but a few seconds before she pulled back, standing up straight and putting on the face of the Amarlin.
So young, he thought, to have so much required of her.
Of course, she wasn't much younger than Althor himself. Gowan was pleased and a little surprised that thinking of the man did not provoke any anger. Althor would fight his fight. Really, what the man did was none of Gowan's business. Gowan led Egwene to the Green Archer section of camp, the several warders at the perimeter greeting them with nods of respect. Meren Sedai had a large tent. Most of the Aes Sedai had been allowed to bring what housing and furniture they wished, so long as they could make their own gateway for it and use their own warders to carry it. If the army had to move quickly, such things would be abandoned. Many Aes Sedai had chosen to bring very little, but others, well, they were not accustomed to austerity. Meren was one of those. Few had brought as much as she. Lyalwyn and Bael Doman waited outside the tent. They had been the ones to inform Meren Sedai that her tent was being borrowed, and that she wasn't to tell anyone that Egwene was the one using it. The secret could be discovered if anyone asked around. They hadn't hidden themselves while walking here. But at the same time, someone asking where the Amarlin was sleeping would draw attention. It was the best protection Gowan could arrange, since Egwene was unwilling to travel each day to sleep. Egwene's emotions immediately turned sour when she saw Lyalwyn.
You did say you wanted to keep her close, Gowan said softly. I don't like her knowing where I sleep. If their assassins do come looking for me in camp, she might be the one to lead them to me.
Gowan fought down the instinct to argue. Egwene was a cunning, insightful woman, but she had a blind spot regarding anything Seanchan. He, on the other hand, found himself trusting Lao Wen. She seemed to be the type who dealt straight with people.
"I'll keep an eye on her," he said.
Egwene composed herself with a breath, then walked to the tent and passed Lao Wen without saying a word. Gawain didn't follow her inside.
"The Amerlin seems intent on not letting me provide service," Lao Wen said to Gawain in that telltale Shonshan drawl.
"She doesn't trust you," Gawain said frankly.
"Is one's oath worth so little on this side of the ocean?" Lao Wen said. "I swore an oath to her that none would break. Not even a Muyami."
"A dark friend will break any oath."
The woman eyed him coolly.
"I begin to think she assumes all Shonshan to be dark friends."
Gawain shrugged.
"You beat her and imprisoned her, making her into an animal to be led by a collar."
"I did not," Lao Wen said. "If one baker made you foul bread, would you assume all of them seek to poison you?"
"Bah! Do not argue. There is no point. If I cannot serve her, then I will serve you. Have you eaten today, warder?"
Gawain hesitated.
"If one baker made you foul bread, would you assume all of them seek to poison you?" "Bah! Do not argue. There is no point. If I cannot serve her, then I will serve you. Have you eaten today, warder?"
Gawain hesitated. When had he last had something to eat? This morning? No, he'd been too eager for the fight. His stomach grumbled loudly.
"I know you will not leave her," Lao Wen said, "particularly under the watch of a Shonshan. Come, Bale, let us fetch this fool some food so that he does not faint if assassins do come."
She stalked off, her large Ilioner husband following. The fellow shot a glare over his shoulder that could have cured leather. Gawain sighed and settled down on the ground. From his pocket he pulled 3 black rings. He selected one, then shoved the others back into his pocket. Talk of assassins always made him think of the rings which he'd taken off the Shonshan who had come to kill Egwene. The rings were Tyr Angreal. They were the means by which those blood knives had moved quickly and blended into shadows. He held up the ring toward the light. It didn't look like any Tyr Angreal he had seen, but an object of the power could look like anything. The rings were of some heavy black stone he did not recognize. The outside was carved like thorns, though the inside surface, the side that touched the skin, was smooth. He turned the ring over in his fingers. He knew that he should go to Egwene with it. He also knew how the White Tower treated Tyr Angreal. They locked the objects away, afraid to experiment with them. But this was the last battle, if there was ever a time to take risks.
"You decided to stand in Egwene's shadow, Gawain," he thought. "You decided you would protect her, do what she needed of you."
She was winning this war, she and the Aes Sedai. Would he let himself grow as jealous of her as he had been of Althor?
"Is that what I believe it to be?"
Gawain snapped his head up, fist closing around the ring. Lao Wen and Bale Doman had been to the mess tent and returned with a bowl for him. From the smell of it, the meal was barley stew again. The cooks used so much pepper it was almost sickening. Gawain suspected they did because the black flecks hid the bits of weevil.
"I can't act like I'm doing something suspicious," he thought immediately. "I can't let her go to Egwene."
"This?" he asked, holding up the ring. "It's one of the rings we recovered from the Shonshan assassins who tried to kill Egwene. We assume it's a Tyr Angreal of some sort, though it's not one the White Tower has ever heard of."
Lao Wen hissed softly. "Those are bestowed only by the Empress, may she—"
She cut herself off and took a deep breath.
"Only one appointed as a blood knife, one who has given their life to the Empress, is allowed to wear such a ring. For you to put one on would be very, very wrong." Fortunately, Gawain said, I'm not wearing it.
The rings are dangerous, Lawin said. I do not know much of them, but they are said to kill those who use them. Do not let your blood touch the ring, as you will activate it, and that could be deadly, Warder.
She handed him the bowl of stew, then strode away. Doman didn't follow her. The Iliar scratched at his short beard.
She do not always be the most accommodating of women, my wife, he said to Gawain. But she do be strong and wise. You would do well to listen to her.
Gawain pocketed the ring. Egwene would never allow me to wear it in the first place. That was true, if she knew about it.
Tell your wife that I appreciate the warning. I should warn you that the subject of the assassins is still a very sore subject for the Amarlin. I'd suggest avoiding the topic of the blood knives, or their Tirangrial.
Doman nodded, and then went after Lyawin. Gawain felt only a small prick of shame at the deception. He hadn't said anything untrue, he just didn't want Egwene asking any awkward questions. That ring, and its brothers, represented something. They weren't the way of the Warder. Standing beside Egwene, watching for danger to her, that was the way of the Warder. He would make a difference on the battlefield by serving her, not by riding out like some hero. He told himself that time and time again as he ate his stew. By the time he was done, he was nearly certain he believed it. He still didn't tell Egwene about the rings. Rand remembered the first time he'd seen a Trolloc. Not when they had attacked his farm in the Two Rivers. The true first time he'd seen them. During the Last Age. There will come a time when they no longer exist, he thought, weaving fire and air, creating an explosive wall of flames that roared to life in the middle of a pack of Trollocs. Nearby, men of Perrin's Wolfguard raised weapons in thanks. Rand nodded back. He wore the face of Jer Grady in this fight. For now. Once Trollocs had not scourged the land, they could return to that state. If Rand killed the Dark One, would it happen immediately? The flames of his firewall brought sweat on his forehead. He drew carefully on the fat man Angrial. He couldn't afford to seem too powerful, and struck down another group of Trollocs here on the battlefield just west of the river Alguenya. Elaine's forces had crossed the Aranin and the countryside to the east, and were waiting for their bridges across the Alguenya to be constructed. These were almost completed, but meanwhile a vanguard of Trollocs had caught up with them, and Elaine's army had formed up in defensive positions to hold them off until they could cross the river. Rand was happy to help. The real Jer Grady rested back in his camp in Kandor, worn out from healing. A convenient face that Rand could wear and not draw the attention of the Forsaken. The Trolloc screams were satisfying as they burned. He had loved that sound near the end of the War of Power. It had always made him feel as if he were doing something. He hadn't known what Trollocs were the first time he'd seen them. Oh, he'd known of Agenor's experiments. Luce Theron had named him a madman on more than one occasion. He hadn't understood. So many of them hadn't. Agenor had loved his projects far too much. Luce Theron had made the mistake of assuming that Agenor, like Semirog, enjoyed the torture for its own sake. And then the Shadow Spawn had come. The monsters continued burning, limbs twitching. Still, Rand worried that these things might be humans reborn. Agenor had used people to create the Trollocs and Murdral. Was this the fate of some? To be reborn as twisted creations such as this? The idea sickened him. He checked the sky. The clouds had begun to withdraw as they did near him. He could force them to not do so, but no. Men needed the light,
and he could not fight here too long lest it become obvious that one of the Ashaman was too strong for the face he wore. Rand let the light come. All across the battlefield near the river, people glanced toward the sky as sunlight fell on them, the dark clouds pulling back. No more hiding, Rand thought, removing his mask of mirrors and raising his hand in a fist above his head. He wove air, fire, and water, creating a column of light extending from himself high into the sky. Soldiers across the battlefield cheered. He would not bring down the traps the Dark One had waiting for him. He moved through a gateway back to Marilor. He never stayed long at a battlefront, but he always revealed himself before he left. He let the clouds break above, proving he had been there, then withdrew. Min waited for him at the Marilor traveling ground. He looked behind himself as his gateway closed, leaving the people to fight without him. Min placed a hand on his arm. His maiden guards waited here. They reluctantly allowed him to fight alone, as they knew that their presence would give him away.
"You look sad," Min said softly.
A hot breeze blew from somewhere north. Nearby soldiers saluted him. Most of what he had here were Damani, Tyrans, and Aiel. The assault force, led by Rodil Aitelralda and King Darlan, that would try to hold the valley of Thakandar while Rand wrestled with the Dark One. The time had almost arrived for that. The Shadow had seen him fighting on all fronts. He had joined Lan's fighting, Egwene's fighting, and Elaine's in turn. By now the Shadow had committed most of its armies to the fighting in the south. The time for Rand to strike Shael Ghul was at hand. He looked to Min.
"Moraine calls me a fool for these attacks. She says that even a small risk to me is not worth what I accomplish."
"Moraine is probably right," Min said.
"She often is. But I prefer you as the person who would do this. That is the person who can defeat the Dark One. The man who cannot sit and plan while others die."
Rand put his arm around her waist.
"Light, what would he have done without her? I'd have fallen," he thought. "During the dark months, I'd have fallen for certain."
Over Min's shoulder, Rand saw a gray-haired woman approaching. And behind her, a smaller figure in blue stopped and pointedly turned the other way. Cad Swain and Moiraine gave one another wide berth in the camp. He thought he caught a hint of a glare in Moiraine's eyes when she saw that Cad Swain had spotted Rand first. Cad Swain came up to him, then walked around him, looking him up and down. She nodded to herself several times.
"Trying to decide if I'm up to the task," Rand said to Cad Swain, keeping emotions, in this case annoyance, from his voice.
"I never wondered," Cad Swain said. "Even before I found you were reborn, I never wondered if I would be able to make you into the man you needed to be. Wondering, in that manner at least, is for fools. Are you a fool, Randalthor?"
"An impossible question," Min replied. "If he says that he is, then a fool he becomes. If he says that he is not, then he implies he does not seek further wisdom."
"Pfah! You've been reading too much, child." Cad Swain seemed fond as she said it. She turned to Rand.
"I hope you give her something nice."
"What do you mean?" Rand asked. "You've been giving things to people," Cad Swain said. "In preparation for death. It's common for the elderly or for men riding into a battle they don't think they can win. A sword for your father, a Tirangriol for the Queen of Andor, a crown for Lan Mandragoran, jewelry for the Aiel girl, and for this one."
She nodded at Min. Rand stiffened. He'd known what he was doing on some level, but to hear it explained was disconcerting. Min's expression darkened. Her grip on him tightened.
"Walk with me," Cad Swain said. "Just you and me, Lord Dragon."
She glanced at him.
"If you will."
Min looked to Rand, but he patted her on the shoulder and nodded.
I'll meet you at the tent.
She sighed, but retreated.
Cadswain had already started on the path. Rand had to jog a few steps to catch up. She probably enjoyed seeing that.
Moraine Sedai grows restless with your delays, Cadswain said.
And what are your thoughts?
I think she has a portion of wisdom to her. However, I do not find your plan to be complete idiocy. You must not delay much longer, however.
He purposely did not say when he would give the order to attack Shale Ghul. He wanted everyone guessing. If nobody around him knew when he would strike, then chances were good the Dark One wouldn't know either.
Regardless, Cadswain said, I am not here to speak about your delays. I feel that Moraine Sedai has your education in that matter well in hand. Something else worries me far more.
And that is?
That you expect to die. That you are giving so much away. That you do not even seek to live.
Rand took a deep breath. Behind, a group of maidens trailed him. He passed the windfinders in their small camp, huddled and speaking over the bowl of winds. They looked toward him and Cadswain with placid faces.
Leave me go to my fate, Cadswain, Rand said. I have embraced death. I will take it when it comes. I am pleased at that, she said. And do not think, for a moment, that I would not trade your life for the world.
You've made that obvious from the start, Rand said. So why worry now? This fight will claim me, so it must be.
You must not assume that you will die, Cadswain said. Even if it is nearly inevitable, you must not take it as completely inevitable.
Elaine said much the same thing.
Then she has spoken wisdom at least once in her life, a better average than I had assumed of that one.
Rand refused to rise to that comment, and Cadswain let slip a smile. She was pleased at how he controlled himself now. That was why she tested him. Would the tests never end?
No, he thought. Not until the final one. The one that matters most.
Cadswain stopped in the path, causing him to stop as well.
Do you have a gift for me as well?
I am giving them to those I care about. That actually made her smile more deeply.
Our interactions have not always been smooth, Rand Althor. That would be one way to say it. However, she continued, eyeing him, I will have you know that I am pleased. You have turned out well.
So I have your permission to save the world?
Yes.
She looked upward, where the dark clouds boiled. They began to split at his presence, as he did not try to mask it or keep them back.
Yes, Cadswain repeated, you have my permission. So long as you do it soon, that darkness grows.
As if in concert with her words, the ground rumbled. It did that more and more lately. The camp shook and men stumbled, wary.
They will be forsaken, Rand said, once I enter. Someone will need to face them. I intend to ask Avienda to lead the resistance against them. She could use your aid.
Cadswain nodded.
I will do my part. Bring Olivia, Rand said.
She is strong, but I worry about putting her with others. She does not understand limits in the way that she should. Cadswain nodded again, and from the look in her eyes, he wondered if she'd already planned to do just that.
And the Black Tower?
Rand set his jaw. The Black Tower was a trap. He knew it was a trap. Taim wanted to lure Rand into a place where he couldn't escape through a gateway.
I sent Perrin to help. And your determination to go yourself?
I have to help them, somehow. I let Taim gather them. I can't just leave them to him.
You still aren't certain, Cadswain said, dissatisfied. You'd risk yourself, you'd risk us all stepping into a trap. They're free, Cadswain turned to walk away. Taim and his men have been cast out of the Black Tower. What? Rand demanded, taking her by the arm. Your men there freed themselves, Cadswain said, though from what I've been told they took a beating doing it. Few know it. Queen Elaine might not be able to use them in battle for some time. I don't know the details.
They freed themselves? Rand said.
Yes.
They did it, or Perrin did.
Rand exulted, but a wave of guilt slammed against him. How many had been lost? Could he have saved them if he'd gone? He'd known for days now of their predicament, and yet he'd left them, obeying Moraine's insistent counsel that this was a trap he could not afford to spring. And now they'd escaped it. I wish that I'd been able to draw an answer out of you, Cadswain said, about what you intended to do there. She sighed, then shook her head. You have cracks in you, Randalthor, but you'll have to do. She left him.
Deep was a good man, Antile said. He survived the fall of Meridon. He was on the wall when it blew, but he lived and kept fighting. The Dreadlords came for him eventually, sending an explosion to finish the job. Deep spent the last moments throwing weaves at them. He died well.
The Malkyrie soldiers raised cups toward Antile, saluting the fallen. Lan raised his own cup, though he stood just outside the ring of men around the fire. He wished Deep had followed orders. He shook his head, downing his wine. Though it was night, Lan's men were on rotation to be awake in case of an attack. Lan turned his cup between two fingers, thinking of Deep again. He found he couldn't drum up anger at the man. Deep had wanted to kill one of the Shadow's most dangerous channelers. Lan couldn't say he would turn down a similar opportunity if it were given him. The men continued their toasts to the fallen. It had become a tradition every evening, and had spread among all of the Borderlander camps. Lan found it encouraging that the men here were starting to treat Antile and Narishma as fellows. The Ashaman were aloof, but Deep's death had forged a link between the Ashaman and the ordinary soldiers. Now they'd all paid the butcher's bill. The men had seen Antile grieving, and had invited him to make a toast. Lan stepped away from the fire and walked through the camp, stopping by the horse lines to check on Mandarb. The stallion was holding up well, though he bore a large wound on his left flank where his coat would never grow back. It seemed to be healing well. The grooms still spoke in hushed tones about how the wounded horse had appeared out of the night following the fight where Deep had died. Many riders had been killed or unhorsed in the fighting that day. Very few horses had escaped the Trollocs and made their way back to camp. Lan patted Mandarb's neck.
We'll rest soon, my friend, he said softly. I promise.
Mandarb snorted in the darkness, and nearby, several of the other horses nickered.
We'll make a home, Lan said. The Shadow defeated, Nynaeve and I will reclaim Malkyr. We'll make the fields bloom again, cleanse the lakes, green pastures. No more Trollocs to fight. Children to ride on your back, old friend. You can spend your days in peace, eating apples and having your pick of mares.
It had been a very long time since Lan had thought of the future with anything resembling hope. Strange to find it now, in this place, in this war. He was a hard man. At times he felt he had more in common with the rocks and the sand than he did with the men who laughed together beside the fire. That was what he'd made of himself. It was the person he'd needed to be, a person who could someday journey toward Malkyr and uphold the honor of his family. Randalthor had begun to crack that shell, and then Nynaeve's love had ripped it apart completely.
I wonder if Rand ever knew, Lan thought, taking out the curry comb and working on Mandarb's coat. Lan knew what it was like to be chosen from childhood to die. He knew what it was like to be pointed toward the Blight and told he would sacrifice his life there. Like what he did. Randall Thor would probably never know how similar the two of them were. Lan brushed Mandarb for a time, though he was bone-tired. Perhaps he should have slept. Nynaeve would have told him to sleep. He played out the conversation in his head, allowing himself a smile. She'd have won, explaining that a general needed sleep and that there were plenty of grooms to care for the horses. But Nynaeve wasn't there. He kept brushing. Someone approached the horse lines. Lan heard the footsteps long before the person arrived, of course. Lord Balderi retrieved a brush from the groom station, nodding to one of the guards there, and walked toward his own horse. Only then did he notice Lan.
"Lord Mandragoran," he said.
"Lord Balderi," Lan said, nodding toward the Kandori. Queen Atheniella's sword-bearer was slender, with streaks of white in his otherwise black hair. Though Balderi was not one of the great captains, he was a fine commander, and had served Kandor well since his king's death. Many had assumed that the queen would marry Balderi. That, of course, was foolish. Atheniella looked at him as she would a brother. Besides, anyone who paid attention would know that Balderi clearly preferred men to women.
"I am sorry to disturb you, Darshan," Balderi said. "I had not realized that anyone else would be here."
He moved to withdraw.
"I was nearly done," Lan said. "Do not let me stop you."
"The grooms do well enough," Balderi said. "I wasn't here to check on their work. I have found, at times, that doing something simple and familiar helps me think."
"You're not the only one to have noticed that," Lan said, continuing to brush Mandarb.
Balderi chuckled, then fell silent for a moment. Finally he spoke.
"Darshan," he said, "are you worried about Lord Agelmar?"
"In what regard?"
"I worry that he's pushing himself too hard," Balderi said. "Some of the choices he is making, they confuse me. It's not that his battle decisions are bad. They simply strike me as too aggressive."
"It is war. I don't know that one can be too aggressive in defeating one's enemy."
Balderi fell quiet for a time.
"Of course. But did you notice the loss of Lord Yokata's two cavalry squadrons?"
"That was unfortunate, but mistakes do happen."
"This isn't one that Lord Agelmar should have made. He's been in situations like this before, Darshan. He should have seen."
It had happened during a recent raid against the Trollocs. The Ashaman had been setting fire to Fall Eisen and the surrounding countryside. At Agelmar's orders, Yokata had taken his cavalry in a swing around a large hill to attack the right flank of the Trolloc army advancing on the Ashaman. Using a classic pincer movement, Agelmar was to send in more cavalry against the enemy's left flank, and the Ashaman would turn to meet the Trollocs head-on. But the Shadow's leaders had seen through the maneuver. Before Agelmar and the Ashaman could act, a large contingent of Trollocs had come over the hill to hit Yokata's own right flank, while the remainder hit Yokata head-on, enveloping his cavalry. The cavalry had been killed to the last man. Immediately after, the Trollocs went after the Ashaman, who had barely been able to save themselves.
"He is tired, Darshan," Balderi said. "I know Agelmar. He would never have made a mistake like that if he were awake and alert."
"Balderi, anyone could have made a mistake like that."
"Lord Agelmar is one of the great captains. He should see the battle differently than ordinary men do."
"Are you certain you aren't expecting too much of him?" Lan asked. "Agelmar is just a man. We all are, at the end of the day."
"Perhaps you are right,"
Baldari said, hand on his sword as if worried. He wasn't carrying the Queen's weapon, of course. He did that only when she was acting in her station. I guess it comes down to an instinct, Lan. An itch. Agomar seems tired a lot, and I worry it's affecting his ability to plan. Please, just watch him.
I'll watch, Lan said.
Thank you, Baldari said. He seemed less troubled now than when he'd approached. Lan gave Mandarb a final pat, left Baldari to tend his horse, and walked through camp to the command tent. He went in. The tent was lit and well guarded, though the soldiers on guard weren't allowed clear views of the battle maps. Lan moved around the hung cloths that obstructed the entry and nodded to the two Shinaran commanders, subordinates to Agomar, who attended this inner sanctum. One was studying the maps spread out on the floor. Agomar himself wasn't there. A leader needed to sleep sometime. Lan squatted, looking at the map. After tomorrow's retreat, it appeared that they would reach a place called Blood Springs, named for the way the rocks beneath the water made the river seem to run red. At Blood Springs, they would have a slight advantage of height because of the adjacent hills, and Agomar wanted to stage an offensive against the Trollocs with bowmen and cavalry lines working together. And of course, there would be more burning of the land. Lan knelt on one knee, looking over Agomar's notes about which army would fight where and how he'd divide the attacks. It was ambitious, but nothing looked particularly troublesome to Lan. As he was studying, the tent flaps rustled and Agomar himself entered, speaking softly with Lady Els of Saldaea. He stopped when he saw Lan, excusing himself quietly from his conversation. He approached Lan. Agomar did not slump with exhaustion, but Lan had learned to read beyond a man's posture for signs of tiredness. Redness to the eyes, breath that smelled faintly of flatwort, an herb chewed to keep the mind alert when one had been up too long. Agomar was tired, but so was everyone else in camp.
"Do you approve of what you see, Daishan?"
Agomar asked, kneeling.
"It is very aggressive for a retreat."
"Can we afford any other action?"
Agomar asked.
"We leave a swath of burned land behind us, destroying Shinar almost as surely as if the Shadow had taken her. I will bring Trolloc blood to quench those ashes."
Lan nodded.
"Baldari came to you?"
Agomar asked. Lan looked up sharply. Agomar smiled wanly.
"I assume it was regarding the loss of Yokata and his men?"
"Yes."
"It was a mistake, to be certain,"
Agomar said.
"I wondered if anyone would confront me on it. Baldari is one to believe I should never have made such an error."
"He thinks you're pushing yourself too hard."
"He is clever in tactics,"
Agomar said.
"But he does not know so much as he thinks. His head is full of the stories of great captains. I am not without flaw, Daishan. This will not be my only error. I will see them as I saw this one, and learn from them."
"Still, perhaps we should see that you get more sleep."
"I am perfectly hale, Lord Mandragoran. I know my limits. I have spent my entire life learning them. This battle will push me to my utmost, and I must let it.
But
relieve me or let me be,"
Agomar said, cutting in.
"I will listen to advice, I am not a fool, but I will not be second-guessed."
"Very well," Lan said, rising. "I trust your wisdom."
Agomar nodded, lowering his eyes to his maps. He was still working on his plans when Lan finally left to turn in.
Chapter 19. The Choice of a Patch. Elaine found Bashir pacing on the east bank of the river. Riverbanks were among the few places that still felt alive to her. So much was lifeless these days, trees that did not put forth leaves, grass that did not grow, animals that huddled in their dens and refused to move. The rivers kept flowing. There was a sense of life to that, though the plants were dreary. The Alguenia was one of those deceptively mighty rivers that looked placid from a distance, but could pull a woman under its surface until she drowned. She remembered Bryn making a lesson of that to Gawain once, during a hunting trip they'd taken along it. He'd been speaking to her, too. Maybe to her primarily, though he'd always been careful not to overstep himself with the daughter heir. "Be careful of currents," he'd said. "River currents are one of the most dangerous things under the light, but only because men underestimate them. The surface looks still because nothing is fighting it. Nothing wants to. The fish go along with it, and men stay out of it. All except the fools who think to prove themselves." Elaine stepped down the rocky bank toward Bashir. Her guards stayed behind. Birgitta wasn't with them just now. She was seeing to the archer companies miles downriver, where they were busy pounding the Trollocs building rafts to get them across the river. Birgitta's archers and Talmanis's dragons were doing an outstanding job of reducing the Trolloc numbers there, but it was still only a matter of time before their vast army would pour across the Alguenia. Elaine had pulled her forces out of Andor a week before, and she and Bashir had been pleased with their progress, until they had discovered the trap. "Amazing, isn't it?" she asked, stepping up beside Bashir, who stood at the river's bank. Bashir glanced at her, then nodded. "We don't have anything like it, back home." "What of the Aranella?" "It doesn't grow this big until it's outside of Saldea," he said absently. "This is almost like an ocean, settled right here, dividing bank from bank. It makes me smile, thinking of how the Aiel must have regarded it after first crossing the spine." The two of them were silent for a time. "How bad is it?" Elaine finally asked.
"Bad," Bashir said. "I should have realized. Burn me. I should have seen."
"You can't plan for everything, Bashir."
"Pardon," he said, "but that is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing."
Their march eastward from Braem Wood had gone according to plan. Burning the bridges across the Arranin and the Alguenia, they had taken out large numbers of Trollocs trying to cross after them. Elaine was now on the road that went upriver to the city of Cairhien. Bashir had planned to set up their final confrontation with the Trollocs in hills along the road that lay 20 leagues south of Cairhien. The Shadow had outthought them. Scouts had spotted a second army of Trollocs just to the north of their current position, marching east, heading toward the city of Cairhien itself. Elaine had stripped that city of defenders to fill out her army. Now it was filled only with refugees, and was as crowded as Camelin had been. "How did they do it?" she asked. "Those Trollocs couldn't have come down from Tarwin's Gap."
"There hasn't been enough time for that," Bashir agreed.
"Another waygate?" she asked.
"Perhaps," Bashir said. "Perhaps not."
"How then?" she asked. "Where did that army come from?" "That army of Trollocs was almost close enough to knock on the city gates. Light."
"I made the mistake of thinking like a human," Bashir said. "I accounted for Trolloc marching speed, but not for how the Murdral might push them. A foolish mistake. The army in the woods must have split in two, with half taking a northeastern route through the woods toward Cairhien. It's the only thing I can think of."
"We've been moving as quickly as we can," Elaine said. "How could they have overtaken us?" Her army had gateways. She couldn't move everyone through them as she didn't have enough channelers to hold gateways for long periods. However, she could move the supply carts, the wounded, and the camp followers through. That let them march at the speed of trained soldiers.
"We've moved as quickly as we could, safely," Bashir said. "A human commander would never have pushed his forces into such a terrible march. The terrain they went through had to have been awful. The rivers they had to cross, the forests, the wetlands, light. They must have lost thousands of Trollocs to fatigue during such a march. The Fades risked it, and now they have us in a pincer. The city could be destroyed as well.
Elaine fell silent.
I won't let that happen, she finally said.
Not again. Not if we can prevent it.
Do we have a choice?
Yes, Elaine said. Bashir, you're one of the greatest military minds the land has known. You have resources that no man has ever had before. The dragons, the kinswomen, Ogier willing to fight in battle. You can make this work. I know you can.
You show surprising faith in me for someone you have known a very short time.
Rand trusts you, Elaine said. Even during the dark times, Bashir, when he would look at every second person around him with darkness in his eyes, he trusted you.
Bashir seemed troubled. There is a way.
What is it?
We march and hit the Trollocs near Kyrian as quickly as we can. They're tired. They have to be. If we could beat them quickly before the horde to the south reaches us, we may have a chance. It will be difficult. The northern force probably wants to seize the city, then use it against us as the southern Trollocs arrive.
Could we open gateways into the city and hold it?
I doubt it, Bashir said. Not with channelers as tired as these. Beyond that, we need to destroy the northern Trollocs, not just hold against them. If we give them time to rest, they will recover from their march, be joined by the Trollocs from the south, then use Dreadlords to rip open Kyrian like an overripe apple. No, Elaine. We have to attack and crush that northern army while it is weak. Only then could we possibly hold against the southern one. If we fail, the two will smash us between them.
It is the risk we must take, Elaine said.
Make your plans, Bashir. We'll make them work.
Egwene stepped into Telaran Riod. The world of dreams had always been dangerous, unpredictable. Lately it was even more so. The grand city of Tyr reflected strangely in the dream, the buildings weathered as if by 100 years of storms. The city walls were now little more than 10 feet high, their tops rounded and smooth, blown by the wind. Buildings inside had worn away, leaving foundations and lumps of weathered stone. Chilled by the sight, Egwene turned toward the stone. It at least stood as it had, tall, strong, unchanged by the weathering of the winds. That comforted her. She sent herself into its heart. The wise ones waited for her. That, too, was comforting. Even in this time of change and tempest, they were solid like the stone itself. Amice, Bear, and Milane waited for her. She overheard part of their conversation before they noticed her.
I saw it just as she did, Bear was saying, though it was my own descendants who lent me their eyes. I think we will all see it now if we return the third time. It should be required. 3 visits, Milane said. That brings change indeed. We still do not know if the second visit will show this or the previous vision.
Conscious of her eavesdropping, Egwene cleared her throat. They turned toward her, immediately falling silent.
I did not mean to intrude, Egwene said, walking among the columns and joining them.
It is nothing, Bear said. We should have guarded our tongues. We were the ones to invite you here to meet us, after all.
It is good to see you, Egwene Alvir, Milane said, smiling with affection. The woman looked so far along in her pregnancy she must be close to delivering.
From reports, your army gains much ji.
We do well, Egwene said, settling herself on the floor with them.
You shall have your own chance, Milane.
The Kara Khan delays, Amice said, frowning. The spears grow impatient. We should be moving against Sightblinder.
He likes to prepare and plan, Egwene said. She hesitated. I cannot remain with you long. I have a meeting with him later today.
About what? Bear asked, leaning forward, curious.
I don't know, Egwene said. I found a letter from him on the floor of my tent. He said he wanted to see me, but not as Dragon and Amerlin, as old friends.
Tell him that he must not dally, Bear said.
But here, there is something we need to speak of with you.
What is it? Egwene asked, curious.
Have you ever seen anything like this? Milane said, concentrating. On the floor between them, the rock split with cracks. She was imposing her will upon the world of dreams, creating something specific for Egwene to see. At first, she was confused. Cracks in the rock? Of course she had seen cracks in rock before. And with the earthquakes striking the land so often recently, they were probably becoming even more common. There was something distinctive about these. Egwene leaned forward and found that the cracks seemed to empty into nothing, a deep blackness, unnaturally so.
What is it? Egwene asked.
Our people report seeing these, Amice said softly. Those fighting in Andor and those in the Blasted Lands with Randall Thor. They appear like fractures in the pattern itself. They remain dark like that for a few moments, then fade, leaving behind ordinary cracks.
It is a very dangerous sign, Bear said. We sent one of ours to ask at the Borderlands, where Lan Mandragoran fights. It appears that the cracks are most common there.
They appear more frequently when the Dreadlords fight, Amice said, when they use the weave known as Balefire.
Egwene stared at that darkness, shivering.
Balefire weakens the pattern. During the War of Power, even the Forsaken grew to fear using it, lest they unravel the world itself.
We must spread the word to all of our allies, Amice said. We must not use this weave.
It is forbidden of Aes Sedai already, Egwene said. But I will make it known that nobody is to consider breaking that rule.
That is wise, Milane said. For a people with so many rules for themselves, I have found that the Aes Sedai are very proficient at ignoring guidelines if their situation allows it.
We trust our women, Egwene said. The oaths hold them, otherwise their own wisdom must guide them. If Moiraine had not been willing to bend this rule, Perrin would be dead. As would Matt, had Rand ignored the rule, but I will speak to the women.
Balefire bothered her. Not that it existed or did what it did. It was uniquely dangerous. And yet, what was it Perrin had said to her in the dream?
It's only another weave.
It seemed unfair that the Shadow should have access to such a weapon as this. One that unraveled the pattern as it was used. How would they fight it? How could they counter it?
This is not the only reason we sent to you, Egwene Alvear, Milane said. You have seen the changes to the world of dreams.
Egwene nodded.
The storm grows worse here.
We will not be visiting here often in the future, Amice said. We have made the decision. And despite our complaints about him, the Karakarn does prepare his armies to move. It will not be long before we march with him to the Shadow's own hold.
Egwene nodded slowly.
So this is it.
I am proud of you, girl, Amice said.
Amice, tough as rocks Amice, looked teary-eyed.
They rose, and Egwene embraced them one at a time.
Light shelter you, Amice, Milane, Bear, Egwene said. Give my love to the others.
It shall be done, Egwene Alvear, Bear said. May you find water and shade, now and always.
One by one they faded from Tyr.
Egwene took a deep breath, looking upward. The building groaned like a ship in a tempest. The rock itself seemed to shift around her. She had loved this place, not the stone, but Talaran Riad. It had taught her so much. But she knew, as she prepared to leave, that it was like a river in dangerous flood. Familiar and loved it might be, but she could not risk herself here. Not while the White Tower needed her. "And farewell to you, old friend," she said to the air. "Until I dream again," she let herself wake. Gawain waited beside the bed as usual. They were back in the tower, Egwene fully dressed, in the chamber near her study. It was not yet evening, but the request from the Wise One was not something she had wished to ignore. "He's here," Gawain said quietly, glancing at the door to her study. "Then let us meet him," Egwene said. She prepared herself, rising, smoothing her skirt. She nodded to Gawain, and they stepped out and went to meet the dragon reborn. Rand smiled when he saw her. He waited inside with two maidens she did not know. "What is this about?" Egwene asked tiredly. "Convincing me to break the seals?"
"You've grown cynical," Rand noted.
"The last two times we met," Egwene said, "you pointedly tried to infuriate me. Am I not to expect it again?"
"I'm not trying to infuriate you," Rand said. "Look, here."
He pulled something from his pocket. A hair ribbon. He held it out to her.
"You always looked forward so to being able to braid your hair."
"So now you imply I'm a child?" Egwene asked, exasperated. Gawain rested a hand on her shoulder, comforting.
"What? No!" Rand sighed. "Light, Egwene, I want to make amends. You're like a sister to me. I never had siblings. Or at least the one I have doesn't know me. I only have you. Please. I'm not trying to rile you."
For a moment, he seemed just as he had long ago, an innocent boy, earnest. Egwene let her frustration melt away. "Rand, I'm busy. We are busy. There isn't time for things like this. Your armies are impatient."
"Their time will soon come," Rand said, growing harder. "Before this is through, they will wonder why they were so eager, and will look with longing at these restful days waiting."
He still held the ribbon in his hand, forming a fist.
I didn't want to go to my fight with our last meeting having been an argument, even if it was an important one."
"Oh, Rand," Egwene said. She stepped forward, taking the ribbon. She embraced him. Light, but he'd been difficult to deal with lately. But she'd thought the same thing about her parents on occasion. "I support you. It doesn't mean I'm going to do as you say with the seals, but I do support you." Egwene released Rand. She would not be teary-eyed, even if it did seem like a last parting for them.
"Wait," Gawain said. "Sibling? You have a sibling?" "I am the son of Tigraine," Rand said, shrugging. "Born after she went to the waste and became a maiden."
Gawain looked stunned, though Egwene had figured this out ages ago.
"You are Galad's brother?" Gawain asked. "Half-brother," Rand said. "Not that it would probably mean much to a white cloak. We had the same mother. His father, like yours, was Charingal, but mine was an Aiel." "I think Galad would surprise you," Gawain said softly. "But Elaine..." "Not to tell you your own family history, but Elaine is not related to me."
Rand turned to Egwene.
"May I see them? The seals. Before I go to Sheol Ghul, I would look upon them one last time. I promise not to do anything with them."
Reluctantly, she fished them from the pouch at her waist, where she often kept them. Gawain, still looking stunned, walked to the window and pushed it open, letting light into the room. The White Tower felt still, silent. Its armies were gone, its masters at war. She unwrapped the first seal and handed it to Rand. She would not give him all of them at once, just in case. She did trust his word, it was Rand after all, but just in case. Rand held up the seal, staring at it, as if seeking wisdom in that sinuous line. "I crafted these," he whispered. "I made them to never break. But I knew as I did it that they would eventually fail. Everything eventually fails when he touches it." Egwene hefted another of the seals, holding it gingerly. It would not do to break the thing by accident. She kept them wrapped and the pouch stuffed with cloth. She worried about breaking them while carrying them, but Moiraine had indicated that Egwene would break them. She felt that was foolish, but the words she had read, the things Moiraine had said. Well, if the moment did come to break them, Egwene would need to have them at hand, and so she carried them. Carried with her the potential death of the world itself. Rand suddenly went as white as a sheet. "Egwene," he said, "this does not fool me." "What doesn't?" He looked at her. "This is a fake. Please, it is all right. Tell me the truth. You made a copy and gave it to me."
"I did nothing of the sort," she said.
"Oh. Oh, light." Rand raised the seal again. "It's a fake."
"What?"
Egwene snatched it from his hand, feeling it. She sensed nothing wrong.
"How can you be sure?"
"I made them," Rand said. "I know my handiwork. This is not one of the seals. It is like someone took them."
"I've had these with me each moment since you gave them to me," Egwene said.
"Then it happened before," Rand whispered. "I didn't look them over carefully after I fetched them. He knew somehow where I'd put them."
Taking the other one from her, he shook his head.
"It's not real either." He took the third. "Nor this one."
He looked at her.
"He has them, Egwene. He's stolen them back somehow. The Dark One holds the keys to his own prison."
For much of Matt's life, he had wished that people would not look at him so much. They gave him frowns at the trouble he had ostensibly caused, trouble that really was not his fault, and glances of disapproval when he walked about completely innocent, trying his best to be pleasant. Every boy filched a pie now and then. No harm in it. It was practically expected. Normal life had been harder for Matt than for other boys. For no good reason, everyone watched him extra carefully. Perrin could have stolen pies all day, and people would have just smiled at him and maybe mussed his hair. Matt, they came at with the broom. When he entered a place to dice, he drew looks. People watched him as they would watch a cheater, though he never was, or with envy in their eyes. Yes, he had always figured that not being watched would be a grand situation. A cause for real celebration. Now he had it, and it made him sick. "You can look at me," Matt protested. "Really. Burn you, it's all right."
"My eyes would be lowered," the serving woman said, as she piled fabric on the low table against the wall.
"Your eyes are already lowered. They're staring at the bloody floor, aren't they? I want you to raise them." The Seanchan continued her work. She was of fair skin, with freckles under her eyes, not too bad to look at, though he was more in favor of darker shades these days. He still would not have minded if this girl showed him a smile. How could he talk to a woman if he could not try to make her smile? A few other servants entered, eyes downcast, carrying other folds of fabric. Matt stood in what were apparently his chambers in the palace. They were more numerous than he would ever need. Perhaps Telmanis and some of the band could move in with him and keep the place from feeling so empty. Matt sauntered over to the window. Below, in the Molhara, an army organized. It was going to take longer than he wanted. Galgan, Matt had only met the man briefly, and he did not trust the fellow, no matter what Tuan said about his assassins not being intended to succeed, was gathering the Shanchan forces from the borders, but too slowly. He worried about losing Almuth Plain with the withdrawal. Well, he had better listen to reason. Matt had little reason to like the man already, but if he delayed in this...
Honored one,
the serving girl asked. Matt turned, raising an eyebrow. Several Daco Vale had entered with the last of the fabric, and Matt found himself blushing. They hardly wore any clothing at all, and what they did wear was transparent. He could look, though, could he not? They would not wear clothing like that if a man was not supposed to look. What would Tuon think? She doesn't own me, Matt thought, determined. I will not be husbandly. The freckled servant, she was Sojin, half of her head shaved, gestured toward a person who had entered behind the Daco Vale, a middle-aged woman with her dark hair in a bun, none of her head shaved. She was squat, shaped kind of like a bell, with a grandmotherly air. The newcomer inspected him. Finally, someone who would look at him. If only her face did not have the expression of one studying horses at the market.
Black, for his new station, the woman said, clapping her hands once. Green, for his heritage. A deep forest, in moderation. Someone bring me a variety of eye patches, and someone else burn that hat.
What? Matt exclaimed. Servants swarmed around him, picking at his clothing.
Wait now! What is this? Your new regalia, honored one, the woman said. I am Nata, and I will be your personal tailor.
You aren't burning my hat, Matt said. Try, and we'll bloody well see if you can fly from four stories up. Do you understand me? The woman hesitated.
Yes, honored one. Do not burn his clothing. Keep it safe. Should it be needed?
She seemed doubtful it ever would be. Matt opened his mouth to complain further, and then one of the Daco Vale opened a box. Jewelry shone inside it. Rubies, emeralds, fire drops. Matt's breath caught in his throat. There was a fortune in there. He was so stunned that he almost did not notice that the servants were undressing him. They pulled at his shirt, and Matt let them. Although he held onto his scarf, he was not bashful. That blush on his cheeks had nothing to do with his trousers being taken off. He was just surprised at the jewelry. Then one of the young Daco Vale reached for Matt's small clothes. You'd be real funny without any fingers, Matt growled. The Daco Vale looked up, his eyes widening, face paling. He immediately looked down again, bowing, backing away. Matt was not bashful, but the small clothes were far enough. Nata clicked her tongue. Her servants began draping Matt in fine cloth, black and deep green, so dark it was nearly black itself.
We shall tailor you outfits for military expression, court attendance, private functions, and civic appearances. It...
No, Matt said. Military only.
But... We're at the bloody last battle, woman, Matt said. If we survive this, you can make me a bloody feast day cap. Until then, we're at war, and I don't need anything else.
She nodded. Matt reluctantly stood with arms out to the sides, letting them drape him in the fabric, taking measurements. If he had to put up with this business of being called Honored One and Highness, then he could at least make certain he was dressed in a reasonable way. In truth, he had been growing tired of the same old clothing. There did not seem to be much lace used by the Shanchan tailor, which was a shame, but Matt did not want to correct her in doing her job. He could not complain about every little thing. Nobody liked a complainer, least of all Matt. As they dealt with the measurements, a servant approached with a small velvet-lined case displaying a variety of eye patches. He hesitated, considering. Some were marked with gemstones, others painted with designs. That one, he said, pointing at the least ornamented patch.
simple black, with only two small rubies, cut thin and long, set at the right and left edges of the patch opposite one another. They fitted it on him as the other servants finished measuring. That done, the tailor had her servants dress him in a costume she had brought. Apparently, he was not going to be allowed back to his old clothing while he waited for his new outfits to be tailored. The clothing started off simple enough. A silk robe of fine weave. Matt would have preferred trousers, but the robe was comfortable. However, they overlaid it with a larger, stiffer robe. It was also silk, of dark green, every inch of it embroidered with scrollwork patterns. The sleeves were large enough to trot a horse through, and they felt heavy and bulky. "I thought I said to give me warrior's clothing," he said.
"This is a ceremonial warrior's uniform for a member of the Imperial family, Highness," Nata said. "Many will see you as an outsider, and though nobody would question your loyalty, it would be well for our soldiers to see you as Prince of the Ravens first, and an Outlander second. Would you agree?"
"I suppose," Matt said. The servants continued, buckling on an ornate girdle and placing forearm bands of the same design on his arms inside the large sleeves. That was all right, Matt supposed, as the girdle pulled in the waist of the clothing and kept it from feeling quite so bulky. Unfortunately, the next piece of clothing was the most ridiculous of all. The stiff, pale piece of cloth fitted onto his shoulders. It draped down his front and back like a tabard, the sides open, but they flared out to the sides a good foot each, making him seem inhumanly wide. They were like shoulder plates from heavy armor, only made of cloth.
"Here now," Matt said. "This isn't a kind of trick you play on a fellow just because he's new, is it?"
"Trick, honored one?" Nata asked.
"You can't really..." Matt trailed off as someone passed outside his door. Another commander. The man was wearing a costume not unlike Matt's, though not as ornate, and with shoulders not quite as wide. Not Imperial family armor, but ceremonial armor for one of the blood. Still, it was almost as lavish. The man stopped and bowed to Matt, then continued on his way.
"Burn me," Matt said. Nata clapped, and the servants began draping Matt in gemstones. They chose mostly rubies, which made Matt uncomfortable. That had to be a coincidence, did it not? He did not know what he thought of being covered in all of these gemstones. Perhaps he could sell them. Actually, if he could put these on a gambling table, he could probably end up owning all of Ebu Dar. Tuon already owns it, he realized. And I married her. It sank in that he was rich. Really rich. He sat there, letting them lacquer his nails as he considered what this all meant. Oh, he had not needed to worry about money for some time, as he could always gamble for more. This was different. If he already had everything, what point was there to gambling? This did not sound like much fun. People were not supposed to give you things like this. You were supposed to find a way to come to them yourself, by wits, luck, or skill. "Burn me," Matt said, lowering his arms to his side as the lacquering finished. "I'm a bloody nobleman." He sighed, plucking his hat from the hands of a startled servant, who was walking past with his old clothing, and set it on his head.
"Honored one," Nata said. "Please forgive my forwardness, but it is my place to advise you on fashion, if you please. That hat looks... particularly out of place with that uniform."
"Who cares?" Matt said, marching out of the room. He almost had to go out the door sideways. "If I'm going to look ridiculous, I might as well do it with style. Someone point me toward where our flaming generals are meeting. I need to figure out how many troops we have."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.